Medra woke in pain, in darkness. For a long time, that was all there was. The pain came and went, the darkness remained. Once it lightened a little into a sort of twilight. He saw a slope running down from where he lay towards a wall of stones, across which was darkness again. But he could not get up to walk to the wall, and presently the pain came back very sharp in his arm and hip and head. Then the darkness came around him, and then nothing. Thirst, and with it pain. Thirst, and the sound of water running. He tried to remember how to make light. Anyeb said to him plaintively, "Can't you make the light?" But he could not. He crawled in the dark until the sound of water was loud and the rocks under him were wet, and groped till his hand found water. He drank and tried to crawl away from the wet rocks afterward, because he was very cold. One arm hurt and had no strength in it. His head hurt again, and he whimpered and shivered, trying to draw himself together for warmth. There was no warmth and no light. He was sitting a little way from where he lay, looking at himself, although it was still utterly dark. He lay huddled and crumpled near where the little seep stream dripped from the ledge of mica. Not far away lay another huddled heap, rotted red silk, long hair, bones. Beyond it the cavern stretched away. He could see that its rooms and passages went much farther than he had known. He saw it with the same uncaring interest with which he saw Tinnerol's body and his own body. He felt a mild regret. It was only fair that he should die here with the man he had killed. It was right. Nothing was wrong. But something in him ached. Not the sharp body pain. A long ache. Lifelong. Anyeb, he said. Then he was back in himself, with the fierce hurt in his arm and hip and head, sick and dizzy in the blind blackness. When he moved, he whimpered, but he sat up. "I have to live," he thought. "I have to remember how to live, how to make light. I have to remember. I have to remember the shadows of the leaves. How far does the forest go? As far as the mind goes." He looked up into the darkness. After a while he moved his good hand a little, and the faint light flowed out of it. The roof of the cavern was far above him. The trickle of water dripping from the mica ledge glittered in short dashes in the warelight. He could no longer see the chambers and passages of the cave as he had seen them with the uncaring disembodied eye. He could only see what the flicker of warelight showed him just around him and before him, as when he had gone through the night with Anyeb to her death, each step into the dark. He got to his knees and thought then to whisper, "Thank you, Mother." He got to his feet and fell, because his left hip gave way with a pain that made him cry out loud. After a while he tried again and stood up, and then he started forward. It took him a long time to cross the cavern. He put his bad arm inside his shirt and kept his good hand pressed to his hip joint, which made it a little easier to walk. The walls narrowed somewhat to a passage. Here the roof was much lower, just above his head. Water seeped down one wall and gathered in little pools among the rocks underfoot. It was not the marvelous red palace of Tinnerol's vision, mystic runes on high branching columns. It was only the earth, only dirt, rock, water. The air was cool and still. Away from the dripping of the stream, it was silent. Outside the gleam of warelight, it was dark. Medra bowed his head, standing there. "Anyeb," he said, "can you come back this far? I don't know the way." He waited a while. He saw darkness, heard silence. Slow and halting, he entered the passage. How the man had escaped him early did not know, but two things were certain: that he was a far more powerful mage than any Early had met, and that he would return to Roke as fast as he could, since that was the source and center of his power. There was no use trying to get there before him. He had the lead. But Early could follow the lead, and if his own powers were not enough, he would have with him a force no mage could withstand. Had not even Morred been brought down not by the craft of the enemy mage, but overwhelmed by the enemy's hordes of warriors? "Your Majesty is sending forth his fleet," Early said to the old man in the armchair in the palace of the kings. "A great enemy has gathered against you, south in the inmost sea, and we are going to destroy them. 100 ships will sail from the great port, and from Omer and Southport, and your fiefdom on Hosk, the greatest navy the world has seen. I shall lead them, and the glory will be yours," he said with an open laugh, so that Lothlin stared at him in a kind of horror, finally beginning to understand who was the master, who the slave. So well in hand did Early have Lothlin's men that within 2 days the great fleet set forth from Havnor, gathering its tributaries on the way. 80 ships sailed past Ark and Ilion on a true and steady mage wind that bore them straight for Roke. Sometimes Early, in his white silk robe, holding a tall white staff, the horn of a sea beast from the farthest north, stood in the decked prow of the lead galley, whose 100 oars flashed, beating like the wings of a gull. Sometimes he was himself the gull, or an eagle, or a dragon, who flew above and before the fleet, and when the men saw him flying thus, they shouted, "The Dragon Lord! The Dragon Lord!" They came ashore in Ilion for water and food. Setting a host of many hundreds of men on its way so quickly had left little time for provisioning of the ships. They overran the towns along the west shore of Ilion, taking what they wanted, and they did the same on Visti and Camari, looting what they could and burning what they left. Then the great fleet turned west, heading for the one harbor of Roke Island, the Bay of Thwil. Early knew of the harbor from the maps in Havnor, and knew there was a high hill above it. As they came nearer, he took dragon form, and soared up high above his ships, leading them, gazing into the west for the sight of that hill. When he saw it, faint and green above the misty sea, he cried out. The men in the ships heard the dragon scream, and flew on faster, leaving them to follow him to the conquest. All the rumors of Roke had said that it was spell-defended and charm-hidden, invisible to ordinary eyes. If there were any spells woven about that hill or the bay he now saw opening before it, they were gossamer to him, transparent. Nothing blurred his eyes or challenged his will as he flew over the bay, over the little town and a half-finished building on the slope above it, to the top of the high green hill. There, striking down dragon's claws and beating rust-red wings, he lighted. He stood in his own form. He had not made the change himself. He stood alert, uncertain. The wind blew, the long grass nodded in the wind. Summer was getting on, and the grass was dry now, yellowing. No flowers in it, but the little white heads of the lace foam. A woman came walking up the hill towards him through the long grass. She followed no path, and walked easily, without haste. He thought he had raised his hand in a spell to stop her, but he had not raised his hand, and she came on. She stopped only when she was a couple of arms' length from him, and a little below him still. "Tell me your name," she said, and he said, "Tariel." "Why did you come here, Tariel?" "To destroy you." He stared at her, seeing a round-faced woman, middle-aged, short and strong, with gray in her hair and dark eyes under dark brows, eyes that held his, held him, brought the truth out of his mouth. "Destroy us? Destroy this hill, the trees down there." She looked down to a grove of trees not far from the hill. "Maybe Segoy, who made them, could unmake them. Maybe the earth will destroy herself. Maybe she'll destroy herself through our hands in the end, but not through yours. False king, false dragon, false man. Don't come to Roke Knoll until you know the ground you stand on." She made one gesture of her hand, downward to the earth. Then she turned, and went down the hill through the long grass, the way she had come. There were other people on the hill he saw now, many others, men and women, children, living and spirits of the dead, many, many of them. He was terrified of them, and cowered down, trying to make a spell that would hide him from them all. But he made no spell. He had no magic left in him. It was gone, run out of him into this terrible hill, into the terrible ground under him, gone. He was no wizard, only a man, like the others, powerless. He knew that, knew it absolutely, though he still tried to say spells and raised his arms in the incantation and beat the air in fury. Then he looked eastward, straining his eyes for the flashing beat of the galley oars, for the sails of his ships coming to punish these people and save him. All he saw was a mist on the water, all across the sea beyond the mouth of the bay. As he watched, it thickened and darkened, creeping out over the slow waves. Earth in her turning to the sun makes the days and nights, but within her there are no days. Medra walked through the night. He was very lame, and could not always keep up the wear-light. When it failed, he had to stop and sit down and sleep. The sleep was never death, as he thought it was. He woke, always cold, always in pain, always thirsty, and when he could make a glimmer of the light, he got to his feet and went on. He never saw Anya, but he knew she was there. He followed her. Sometimes there were great rooms. Sometimes there were pools of motionless water. It was hard to break the stillness of their surface, but he drank from them. He thought he had gone down deeper and deeper for a long time till he reached the longest of those pools, and after that the way went up again. Sometimes now Anya followed him. He could say her name, though she did not answer. He could not say the other name, but he could think of the trees, the roots of the trees. This was the kingdom of the roots of the trees. How far does the forest go? As far as forests go. As long as the lives, as deep as the roots of the trees. As long as the leaves cast shadows. There were no shadows here, only the dark, but he went forward and went forward until he saw Anya before him. He saw the flash of her eyes, the cloud of her curling hair. She looked back at him for a moment and then turned aside and ran lightly down a long, steep slope into darkness. Where he stood, it was not wholly dark. The air moved against his face. Far ahead, dim, small, there was a light that was not wear-light. He went forward. He had been crawling for a long time now, dragging the right leg which would not bear his weight. He went forward. He smelled the wind of evening and saw the sky of evening through the branches and leaves of trees. An arched oak root formed the mouth of the cave, no bigger than a man or a badger needed to crawl through. He crawled through. He lay there under the root of the tree, seeing the light fade and a star or two come out among the leaves. That was where Hound found him, miles away from the valley, west of Samore, on the edge of the great forest of Falyun. "Got you," the old man said, looking down at the muddy, lax body. He added, "Too late," regretfully. He stooped to see if he could pick him up or drag him, and felt the faint warmth of life. "You're tough," he said. "Here, wake up. Come on. Otter, wake up." He recognized Hound, though he could not sit up and could barely speak. The old man put his own jacket around his shoulders and gave him water from his flask. Then he squatted down beside him, his back against the immense trunk of the oak, and stared into the forest for a while. It was late morning, hot, summer sunlight filtering down through the leaves in a thousand shades of green. A squirrel scolded far up in the oak, and a jay replied. Hound scratched his neck and sighed. "The wizard's off on the wrong track as usual," he said at last. "Said you'd gone to Roke Island and he'd catch you there. I said nothing. He looked at the man he knew only as Otter. You went in there, that hole, with the old wizard, didn't you? Did you find him? Medra nodded. Hound went, a short, grunting laugh. You find what you look for, don't you? Like me. He saw that his companion was in distress and said, I'll get you out of here. Fetch a carter from the village down there when I've got my breath. Listen, don't fret. I haven't hunted you all these years to give you to Early, the way I gave you to Gellick. I was sorry for that. I thought about it. What I said to you about men of a craft sticking together and who we work for. Couldn't see that I had much choice about that. But having done you a disfavor, I thought if I came across you again, I'd do you a favor, if I could. As one finder to the other. See? Otter's breath was coming hard. Hound put his hand on Otter's hand for a moment, said, Don't worry, and got to his feet. Rest easy, he said. He found a carter who would carry them down to Endlane. Otter's mother and sister were living with cousins while they rebuilt their burned house as best they could. They welcomed him with disbelieving joy. Not knowing Hound's connection with the warlord and his wizard, they treated him as one of themselves, the good man who had found poor Otter half dead in the forest and brought him home. A wise man, said Otter's mother Rose, surely a wise man. Nothing was too good for such a man. Otter was slow to recover, to heal. The bonesetter did what he could about his broken arm and his damaged hip. The wise woman salved the cuts from the rocks on his hands and head and knees. His mother brought him all the delicacies she could find in the gardens and berry thickets, but he lay as weak and wasted as when Hound first brought him. There was no heart in him, the wise woman of Endlane said. It was somewhere else, being eaten up with worry or fear or shame.
So where is it? Hound said.
Otter, after a long silence, said, Roke Island.
Where old Early went with the great fleet.
I see. Friends there.
Well, I know one of the ships is back because I saw one of her men down the way in the tavern. I'll go ask about. Find out if they got to Roke and what happened there. What I can tell you is that it seems old Early is late coming home.
He went, pleased with his joke.
Late coming home,
he repeated and got up. He looked at Otter, who was not much to look at. Rest easy, he said, and went off. He was gone several days. When he returned, riding in a horse-drawn cart, he had such a look about him that Otter's sister hurried in to tell him, Hound's won a battle or a fortune! He's riding behind a city horse in a city cart like a prince. Hound came in on her heels.
Well, he said, in the first place, when I got to the city, I go up to the palace, just to hear the news, and what do I see? I see old King Pirate standing on his legs, shouting out orders like he used to. Standing up. Hasn't stood for years. Shouting orders. And some of 'em did what he said, and some of 'em didn't. So I got out of there. That kind of situation being dangerous in a palace. Then I went about to friends of mine and asked where was old Early, and had the fleet been to Roke and come back and all. Early, they said. Nobody knew about Early. Not a sign of him, nor from him. Maybe I could find them, they said, joking me. They know I love him. As for the ships, some had come back, with the men aboard saying they never came to Roke Island, never saw it, sailed right through where the sea chart said was an island, and there was no island. Then there were some men from one of the great galleys. They said when they got close to where the island should be, they came into a fog as thick as wet cloth, and the sea turned thick, too, so that the oarsmen could barely push the oars through it, and they were caught in that for a day and a night. When they got out, there wasn't another ship of all the fleet on the sea, and the slaves were near rebelling, so the master brought her home as quick as he could. Another, the old Stormcloud, used to be Lawson's own ship, came in while I was there. I talked to some men off her. They said there was nothing but fog and reefs all around where Roke was supposed to be, and so they sailed on with 7 other ships south a ways, and met up with a fleet sailing up from Watort. Maybe the lords there had heard there was a great fleet coming raiding, because they didn't stop to ask questions, but sent wizards fire at our ships and came alongside to board 'em if they could. And the men I talked to said it was a hard fight just to get away from 'em, and not all did. All this time, they had no word from Early, and no weather was worked for them unless they had a bagman of their own aboard. So they came back up the length of the inmost sea, said the man from Stormcloud, one straggling after the other like the dogs that lost the dogfight. Now, do you like the news I bring you? Otter had been struggling with tears. He hid his face. Yes, he said, thanks. Thought you might.
As for King Loson, Hound said, who knows?
He sniffed and sighed. If I was him, I'd retire, he said. I think I'll do that myself. Otter had got control of his face and voice. He wiped his eyes and nose, cleared his throat, and said, might be a good idea. Come to Roke. Safer.
Seems a hard place to find, Hound said.
I can find it, said Otter. There was an old man by our door who opened it to rich or poor. Many came there, both small and great, but few could pass through Medra's gate. So runs the water away, away. So runs the water away. Hound stayed in Endlane. He could make a living as a finder there, and he liked the tavern and Otter's mother's hospitality. By the beginning of autumn, Loson was hanging by a rope round his feet from a window of the Palace of the Kings, rotting, while 6 warlords quarreled over his kingdom, and the ships of the great fleet chased and fought one another across the straits and the wizard-troubled sea. But Hopeful, sailed and steered by 2 young sorcerers from the hand of Havnor, brought Medra safe down the inmost sea to Roke. Ember was on the dock to meet him. Lame and very thin, he came to her and took her hands, but he could not lift his face to hers. He said, I have too many deaths on my heart, Eliel. Come with me to the grove, she said. They went there together and stayed till the winter came. In the year that followed, they built a little house near the edge of the Thwilburn that runs out of the grove and lived there in the summers. They worked and taught in the great house. They saw it go up stone on stone, every stone steeped in spells of protection, endurance, peace. They saw the rule of Roke established, though never so firmly as they might wish, and always against opposition. For mages came from other islands and rose up from among the students of the school, women and men of power, knowledge, and pride, sworn by the rule to work together and for the good of all, but each seeing a different way to do it. Growing old, Eliel wearied of the passions and questions of the school, and was drawn more and more to the trees, where she went alone as far as the mind can go. Medra walked there too, but not so far as she, for he was lame. After she died, he lived a while alone in the small house near the grove. One day in autumn he came back to the school. He went in by the back door, which gives on the path through the fields to Roke Knoll. He came through the halls and the stone corridors to the inmost place, the marble-paved courtyard of the fountain, where the tree Eliel had planted now stood tall, its berries reddening. Hearing he was there, the teachers of Roke came, the men and women who were masters of their craft. Medra had been the finder, until he went to the grove. A young woman now taught that art, as he had taught it to her. I've been thinking, he said. There are 8 of you. 9's a better number. Count me as a master again, if you will. What will you do, Master Turn? Asked the summoner, a gray-haired mage from Ilion. Keep the door, Medra said. Being lame, I won't go far from it. Being old, I'll know what to say to those who come. Being a finder, I'll find out if they belong here. That would spare us much trouble and some danger, said the young finder.
How will you do it? The summoner asked.
I'll ask them their name, Medra said. He smiled. If they'll tell me, they can come in. And when they think they've learned everything, they can go out again. If they can tell me my name.
So it was. For the rest of his life, Medra kept the doors of the great house on rope. The back door that opened out upon the knoll was long called Medra's Gate, even after much else had changed in that house as the centuries passed through it. And still, the ninth master of rope is the doorkeeper. In End Lane and the villages around the foot of On Havnor, women spinning and weaving sing a riddle song, of which the last line has to do, maybe, with the man who was Medra, and Otter, and Tern. Three things were that will not be. Solea's bright isle above the wave, a dragon swimming in the sea, a seabird flying in the grave.
Dark Rose and Diamond. There is a boat song from West Havnar, and it goes like this. Where my love is going, there will I go. Where his boat is rowing, I will row. We will laugh together, together we will cry. If he lives, I will live. If he dies, I die. Where my love is going, there will I go. Where his boat is rowing, I will row. In the west of Havnor, among hills forested with oak and chestnut, is the town of Glade. A while ago, the rich man of that town was a merchant called Golden. Golden owned the mill that cut the oak boards for the ships they built in Havnor Southport and Havnor Greatport. He owned the biggest chestnut groves. He owned the carts and hired the carters that carried the timber and the chestnuts over the hills to be sold. He did very well from trees. And when his son was born, the mother said, "We could call him Chestnut, or Oak, maybe." But the father said, "Diamond." Diamond being, in his estimation, the one thing more precious than gold. So little Diamond grew up in the finest house in Glade, a fat, bright-eyed baby, a ruddy, cheerful boy. He had a sweet singing voice, a true ear, and a love of music, so that his mother, Tuli, called him Song Sparrow and Skylark, among other loving names, for she never really did like Diamond. He trilled and caroled about the house. He knew any tune as soon as he heard it, and invented tunes when he heard none. His mother had the wise woman Tangle teach him the creation of Ea and the deed of the young king, and at sun return, when he was 11 years old, he sang the winter carol for the lord of the western land, who was visiting his domain in the hills above Glade. The lord and his lady praised the boy's singing and gave him a tiny gold box with a diamond set in the lid, which seemed a kind and pretty gift to Diamond and his mother. But Golden was a bit impatient with the singing and the trinkets. "There are more important things for you to do, son," he said, "and greater prizes to be earned." Diamond thought his father meant the business. The loggers, the sawyers, the sawmill, the chestnut groves, the pickers, the carters, the carts. All that work and talk and planning, complicated adult matters. He never felt that it had much to do with him, so how was he to have as much to do with it as his father expected? Maybe he'd find out when he grew up. But in fact, Golden wasn't thinking only about the business. He had observed something about his son that had made him not exactly set his eyes higher than the business, but glance above it from time to time, and then shut his eyes. At first he had thought Diamond had a knack such as many children had, and then lost a stray spark of majory. When he was a little boy, Golden himself had been able to make his own shadow shine and sparkle. His family had praised him for the trick and made him show it off to visitors, and then when he was 7 or 8 he had lost the hang of it, and never could do it again. When he saw Diamond come down the stairs without touching the stairs, he thought his eyes had deceived him. But a few days later he saw the child float up the stairs, just a finger gliding along the oaken banister rail. "Can you do that coming down?" Golden asked, and Diamond said, "Oh yes, like this," and sailed back down, smooth as a cloud on the south wind. "How did you learn to do that?" "I just sort of found out," said the boy. evidently not sure if his father approved. Golden did not praise the boy, not wanting to make him self-conscious or vain about what might be a passing childish gift like his sweet treble voice. There was too much fuss already made over that. But a year or so later he saw Diamond out in the back garden with his playmate Rose. The children were squatting on their haunches, heads close together, laughing. Something intense or uncanny about them made him pause at the window on the stairs landing and watch them. A thing between them was leaping up and down. A frog, a toad, a big cricket. He went out into the garden and came up near them, moving so quietly, though he was a big man, that they, in their absorption, did not hear him. The thing that was hopping up and down on the grass between their bare toes was a rock. When Diamond raised his hand, the rock jumped up in the air, and when he shook his hand a little, the rock hovered in the air, and when he flipped his fingers downward, it fell to earth. "Now you," Diamond said to Rose, and she started to do what he had done, but the rock only twitched a little. "Oh," he whispered, "there's your dad." "That's very clever," Golden said. "Di thought it up," Rose said. Golden did not like the child. She was both outspoken and defensive, both rash and timid. She was a girl, and a year younger than Diamond, and a witch's daughter. He wished his son would play with boys his own age, his own sort, from the respectable families of Glade. Tully insisted on calling the witch the wise woman, but a witch was a witch, and her daughter was no fit companion for Diamond. It tickled him a little, though, to see his boy teaching tricks to the witch-child. "What else can you do, Diamond?" he asked. "Play the flute," Diamond said promptly, and took out of his pocket the little fife his mother had given him for his 12th birthday. He put it to his lips, his fingers danced, and he played a sweet familiar tune from the western coast, "Where My Love Is Going." "Very nice," said the father. "But anybody can play the fife, you know." Diamond glanced at Rose. The girl turned her head away, looking down. "I learned it really quickly," Diamond said. Golden grunted, unimpressed. "It can do it by itself," Diamond said, and held out the fife, away from his lips. His fingers danced on the stops, and the fife played a short jig. It hit several false notes and squealed on the last high note. "I haven't got it right yet," Diamond said, vexed and embarrassed. "Pretty good, pretty good," his father said. "Keep practicing." And he went on. He was not sure what he ought to have said. He did not want to encourage the boy to spend any more time on music or with this girl. He spent too much already, and neither of them would help him get anywhere in life. But this gift, this undeniable gift, the rock hovering, the unblown fife, well, it would be wrong to make too much of it, but probably it should not be discouraged. In Golden's understanding, money was power, but not the only power. There were two others, one equal, one greater. There was birth. When the lord of the western land came to his domain near Glade, Golden was glad to show him fealty. The lord was born to govern and to keep the peace, as Golden was born to deal with commerce and wealth, each in his place, and each, noble or common, if he served well and honestly, deserved honor and respect. But there were also lesser lords whom Golden could buy and sell, lend to, or let beg, men born noble who deserved neither fealty nor honor. Power of birth and power of money were contingent, and must be earned lest they be lost. But beyond the rich and the lordly were those called the men of power, the wizards. Their power, though little exercised, was absolute. In their hands lay the fate of the long kingless kingdom of the archipelago. If Diamond had been born to that kind of power, if that was his gift, then all Golden's dreams and plans of training him in the business and having him help in expanding the carting route to a regular trade with Southport and buying up the chestnut forests above Retchy, all such plans dwindled into trifles. Might Diamond go, as his mother's uncle had gone, to the school of wizards on Roke Island? Might he, as that uncle had done, gain glory for his family and dominion over lord and commoner, becoming a mage in the court of the lord's regent in the great port of Havnar? Golden all but floated up the stairs himself, borne on such visions. But he said nothing to the boy, and nothing to the boy's mother. He was a consciously close-mouthed man, distrustful of visions, until they could be made acts. And she, though a dutiful, loving wife and mother and housekeeper, already made too much of Diamond's talents and accomplishments. Also, like all women, she was inclined to babble and gossip, and indiscriminate in her friendships. The girl Rose hung about with Diamond because Thule encouraged Rose's mother, the witch, to visit, consulting her every time Diamond had a hangnail, and telling her more than she or anyone ought to know about Golden's household. His business was none of the witch's business. On the other hand, Tangle might be able to tell him if his son in fact showed promise, had a talent for magery. But he flinched away from the thought of asking her, asking a witch's opinion on anything, least of all a judgment on his son. He resolved to wait and watch. Being a patient man with a strong will, he did so for 4 years, till Diamond was 16. A big, well-grown youth, good at games and lessons, he was still ruddy-faced and bright-eyed and cheerful. He had taken it hard when his voice changed, the sweet treble going all untuned and hoarse. Golden had hoped that that was the end of his singing, but the boy went on wandering about with itinerant musicians, ballad singers and such, learning all their trash. That was no life for a merchant's son who was to inherit and manage his father's properties and mills and business, and Golden told him so. "Singing time is over, son," he said. "You must think about being a man." Diamond had been given his true name at the springs of the Amia in the hills above Glade. The wizard Hemlock, who had known his great-uncle the mage, came up from Southport to name him. And Hemlock was invited to his name-day party the year after, a big party, beer and food for all, and new clothes, a shirt or skirt or shift for every child, which was an old custom in the west of Havnor, and dancing on the village green in the warm autumn evening. Diamond had many friends, all the boys his age in town and all the girls too. The young people danced, and some of them had a bit too much beer, but nobody misbehaved very badly, and it was a merry and memorable night. The next morning Golden told his son again that he must think about being a man. "I have thought some about it," said the boy in his husky voice. "And?" "Well, I," said Diamond, and stuck. "I'd always counted on you going into the family business," Golden said. His tone was neutral, and Diamond said nothing. "Have you had any ideas on what you want to do?"
"Sometimes."
"Did you talk at all to Master Hemlock?" Diamond hesitated and said,
"No."
He looked a question at his father. "I talked to him last night," Golden said. "He said to me that there are certain natural gifts which it's not only difficult but actually wrong, harmful, to suppress." The light had come back into Diamond's dark eyes. "The master said that such gifts or capacities, untrained, are not only wasted but may be dangerous. The art must be learned and practiced," he said. Diamond's face shone. "But," he said, "it must be learned and practiced for its own sake." Diamond nodded eagerly. "If it's a real gift, an unusual capacity, that's even more true. A witch with her love potions can't do much harm. But even a village sorcerer," he said, "must take care, for if the art is used for base ends, it becomes weak and noxious. Of course, even a sorcerer gets paid. And wizards, as you know, live with lords and have what they wish." Diamond was listening intently, frowning a little. "So, to be blunt about it, if you have this gift, Diamond, it's of no use directly to our business. It has to be cultivated on its own terms and kept under control, learned and mastered. Only then," he said, "can your teachers begin to tell you what to do with it, what good it will do you, or others," he added conscientiously. There was a long pause. "I told him," Golden said, "that I had seen you, with a turn of your hand and a single word, change a wooden carving of a bird into a bird that flew up and sang. I've seen you make a light glow in thin air. You didn't know I was watching. I've watched and said nothing for a long time. I didn't want to make too much of mere childish play, but I believe you have a gift, perhaps a great gift. When I told Master Hemlock what I'd seen you do, he agreed with me. He said that you may go study with him in Southport for a year, or perhaps longer.
"Study with Master Hemlock?"
said Diamond, his voice up half an octave. "If you wish."
I never thought about it. Can I think about it? For a while, a day?
Of course, Golden said, pleased with his son's caution. He had thought Diamond might leap at the offer, which would have been natural, perhaps, but painful to the father, the owl who had, perhaps, hatched out an eagle. For Golden looked on the art magic with genuine humility as something quite beyond him. Not a mere toy such as music or tale-telling, but a practical business, which his business could never quite equal. And he was, though he wouldn't have put it that way, afraid of wizards. A bit contemptuous of sorcerers with their sleights and illusions and gibble-gabble, but afraid of wizards.
"Does Mother know?" Diamond asked.
"She will when the time comes. But she has no part to play in your decision, Diamond. Women know nothing of these matters and have nothing to do with them. You must make your choice alone as a man. Do you understand that?" Golden was earnest, seeing his chance to begin to wean the lad from his mother. She, as a woman, would cling, but he, as a man, must learn to let go. And Diamond nodded sturdily enough to satisfy his father, though he had a thoughtful look.
"Master Hemlock said that he thought I might have a gift, a talent, or..."
Golden assured him that the wizard had actually said so, though, of course, what kind of a gift remained to be seen. The boy's modesty was a great relief to him. He had half-consciously dreaded that Diamond would triumph over him, asserting his power right away, that mysterious, dangerous, incalculable power against which Golden's wealth and mastery and dignity shrank to impotence.
"Thank you, Father," the boy said.
Golden embraced him and left, well pleased with him. Their meeting place was in the Sallows, the willow thickets down by the Amia, as it ran below the smithy. As soon as Rose got there, Diamond said,
"He wants me to go study with Master Hemlock. What am I going to do?"
"Study with the wizard?
He thinks I have this great huge talent for magic."
"Who does?"
"Father does. He saw some of the stuff we were practicing, but he says Hemlock says I should come study with him because it might be dangerous not to."
"Oh,"
and Diamond beat his head with his hands.
"But you do have a talent."
He groaned and scoured his scalp with his knuckles. He was sitting on the dirt in their old play-place, a kind of bower deep in the willows, where they could hear the stream running over the stones nearby and the clang-clang of the smithy further off. The girl sat down facing him.
"Look at all the stuff you can do," she said. "You couldn't do any of it if you didn't have a gift."
"A little gift," Diamond said indistinctly. "Enough for tricks."
"How do you know that?"
Rose was very dark-skinned, with a cloud of crinkled hair, a thin mouth, an intent, serious face. Her face and legs and hands were bare and dirty, her skirt and jacket disreputable. Her dirty toes and fingers were delicate and elegant, and a necklace of amethyst gleamed under the torn, buttonless jacket. Her mother, Tangle, made a good living by curing and healing, bone-knitting and birth-easing, and selling spells of finding, love potions, and sleeping draughts. She could afford to dress herself and her daughter in new clothes, buy shoes, and keep clean,
but it didn't occur to her to do so.
Nor was housekeeping one of her interests. She and Rose lived mostly on boiled chicken and fried eggs, as she was often paid in poultry. The yard of their two-room house was a wilderness of cats and hens. She liked cats, toads, and jewels. The amethyst necklace had been payment for the safe delivery of a son to Golden's head forester. Tangle herself wore armfuls of bracelets and bangles that flashed and crashed when she flicked out an impatient spell. At times she wore a kitten on her shoulder. She was not an attentive mother. Rose had demanded at 7 years old, "Why did you have me if you didn't want me?" "Well, how can you deliver babies properly if you haven't had one?" said her mother. "So I was practice?" Rose snarled. "Everything is practice," Tangle said. She was never ill-natured. She seldom thought to do anything much for her daughter, but never hurt her, never scolded her, and gave her whatever she asked for. Dinner, a toad of her own, the amethyst necklace, lessons in witchcraft. She would have provided new clothes if Rose had asked for them, but she never did. Rose had looked after herself from an early age, and this was one of the reasons Diamond loved her. With her, he knew what freedom was. Without her, he could attain it only when he was hearing and singing and playing music. "I do have a gift," he said now, rubbing his temples and pulling his hair. "Stop destroying your head," Rose told him. "I know Tarry thinks I do."
"Of course you do. What does it matter what Tarry thinks? You already play the harp about 9 times better than he ever did."
This was another of the reasons Diamond loved her. "Are there any wizard musicians?" he asked, looking up. She pondered.
"I don't know."
"I don't either. Morred and Elfaran sang to each other, and he was a mage. I think there's a master chanter on Roque that teaches the lays and the histories. But I never heard of a wizard being a musician." "I don't see why one couldn't be." She never saw why something could not be. Another reason he loved her. "It always seemed to me they're sort of alike," he said. "Magic and music. Spells and tunes. For one thing, you have to get them just exactly right."
"Practice," Rose said rather sourly.
"I know." She flicked a pebble at Diamond. It turned into a butterfly in midair. He flicked a butterfly back at her, and the two flitted and flickered a moment before they fell back to earth as pebbles. Diamond and Rose had worked out several such variations on the old stone-hopping trick.
"You ought to go, Di," she said. "Just to find out."
"I know."
"What if you got to be a wizard? Oh, think of the stuff you could teach me. Shape-changing. We could be anything. Horses, bears,
moles," Diamond said. "Honestly, I feel like hiding underground. I always thought Father was going to make me learn all his kind of stuff after I got my name. But all this year he's kept sort of holding off. I guess he had this in mind all along. But what if I go down there and I'm not any better at being a wizard than I am at bookkeeping? Why can't I do what I know I can do?"
"Well, why can't you do it all? The magic and the music, anyhow. You can always hire a bookkeeper."
When she laughed, her thin face got bright, her thin mouth got wide, and her eyes disappeared. "Oh, Dark Rose," Diamond said, "I love you."
"Of course you do. You'd better. I'll witch you if you don't."
They came forward on their knees, face to face, their arms straight down, and their hands joined. They kissed each other all over their faces. To Rose's lips, Diamond's face was smooth and full as a plum, with just a hint of prickliness above the lip and jawline where he had taken to shaving recently. To Diamond's lips, Rose's face was soft as silk, with just a hint of grittiness on one cheek, which she had rubbed with a dirty hand. They moved a little closer so that their breasts and bellies touched, though their hands stayed down by their sides. They went on kissing.
"Dark Rose,"
he breathed in her ear, his secret name for her. She said nothing, but breathed very warm in his ear. And he moaned. His hands clenched hers. He drew back a little. She drew back. They sat back on their ankles.
"Oh, Di," she said. "It will be awful when you go."
"I won't go," he said. "Anywhere, ever.